Welcome to the ATL Podcast Network.
Mental health in the Black community is so stigmatized. People are more afraid of being labeled crazy than actually living with a mental illness. Like, it's so ironic that people will read every single self-help book there is instead of just going to therapy. Mental health is real, people, and we all have problems. So why not be the best version of you? And if that includes therapy, what's the worst that could happen? Hey everyone, it is therapist KP, aka Kiwash Naomi, and this is another episode of Mental Unwind. I want to thank you all for joining me once again. I appreciate you as always. I have a special guest. All my guests are special. I have a special guest, attorney Derek Gage. Really quick story before I let him introduce himself. I literally just Googled him, so this is how awesome he is. I'm going to put this out here. I know he's like blushing. So I literally Googled him. I was like, I need someone to talk about the legal aspect of mental health because, of course, that's a big concern for a lot of people, especially in the climate that we're in. And I Googled attorneys who deal with mental health. There's very few of you. And he popped up and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to wing it. And I'm just going to email him. And he emailed me back within like hours. And he was like, yeah, I'll do it. And I was like, really? Like, I read the email twice and I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So I am here to introduce attorney Derek Gage. I'm going to allow you to introduce yourself.
I am happy to be here. Yep, I'm Derek Gage. I am the sole partner in the Gage Law Firm, and I've been running since 2012. That was after 7 years as a public defender in DeKalb County, running the mental health unit there.
So okay.
About 15 years of practice and about 13 of those doing primarily mental health criminal defense, some hospital commitment work as well,
okay,
but primarily criminal defense and mental health.
Okay, okay, thank you. So this should be really, really good. So what is, would you say, is the mental health area as it relates to the legal side of it? Because you mentioned that.
Well, I probably look at it a lot differently now than I did when I started practicing in this area. I think, you know, originally I was very focused on legal defenses, things like insanity and competency was my main focus. That's not to say it's not important anymore.
Okay.
But I think nowadays, more than anything, it is trying to put a person in a position, since most of my cases, the evidence is not very favorable to the defendant. And so much of my work is focused now on the mitigation side of things. I'm really trying to put or help a defendant find access to resources to look at their challenges differently, and, you know, let them do all the hard work and then allow me to kind of argue to the other side, educate the other side, educate the judges as to why either this is a case that doesn't need to be prosecuted or, you know, the consequences don't need to be as severe as they might be in other cases.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. So for the listeners, they have heard me talk about this thing called a 1013, which I'm sure you are very familiar with. That is something that therapists, police officers sometimes have to do it, depending on what level the therapist is. Psychologist, psychiatrist, that is basically when we believe that the individual that we are going to 1013 is a danger to themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to put them in an institution to stabilize them, for lack of a better term, to make sure that they don't end up harming themselves or someone else. We'll get to the someone else part. I'll ask about it in a second. So I have it from my stance, right? So I know from my stance, like, okay, this person's going to hurt themselves. I'm going to put them in there. Now, I actually used to work on a locked unit, right? So when the 1013s came in, I was on the unit that they came to, right?
Is that right? Which hospital was that?
I was at Ridgeview. Yes. I was at Ridgeview. I did my internship there. So when I was in my master's program, I did my internship there. So it was my first experience. My very first experience in the mental health field was on a locked unit. And I loved it. I loved every second of it. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. So it was a stabilization unit. So when people were 1013, most of the people who came there, they were 1013. So when they did come in, that it was our job to help stabilize them. Mm-hmm. Now, in that environment, sometimes after the thrust, and the hold, by the way, is 72 hours, right? It's a 72-hour hold. Now, if after 72 hours, we don't believe for whatever reason that you are actually stable, we have to go to court and ask, hey, this is why we don't think that this person should be released at this point in time, and we have to prove it. So I'm assuming I haven't, and when I was there, of course, because I was an intern at the time, I didn't have to deal with that portion of it. So were you, when you were in the defender's office, I think you said at DeKalb, did you have to deal with any of that?
Not directly.
Okay.
I got way more involved in that kind of work when I went into private practice. I would use that route in indigent defense a lot to try to spring somebody from the jail. And so because I was relegated to one jurisdiction, you get to know the judges really well, and they get to trust you and buy into what you're trying to do. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we would use the lay affidavit process a lot of times to move someone from the jail environment to the hospital environment, where at least they could be stabilized, and then, you know, from there, put them in a position where they could post bond and not be, you know, an immediate risk of coming right back in, which is what we tried to avoid.
Uh-huh.
But once I got into private practice, it became a far larger part of my work because, you know, I was getting families calling saying one of two things: either what am I supposed to do with my kid right now? He is, you know, acutely symptomatic. He is running around, you know, speaking in delusions. I can't keep him in the house, or he's homeless. I can't get him to come home. You know, I just want to get him to a hospital someplace where he can't leave and, you know, get him on medicine, stabilize him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side of it was, you know, my kid's been 10-13'd and, you know, they're holding him and he doesn't have these suicidal thoughts. He doesn't have these homicidal thoughts, and yet they still continue to hold him despite this fact, or we want to move him to a different hospital or whatever.
Okay.
So, you know, it was one of those two things, and that became a much larger part, and that got me much more involved with the private hospitals and a more inside look as to how they worked, because I was not quite as involved with them in indigent defense, much more Georgia regional and state hospitals, and then, you know, the forensic side of it.
Okay.
Back then.
So we're going to step a little bit into something that for, at least for therapists, is kind of a sore spot for us in the state of Georgia, at least. So, and for many of you, you aren't aware of the Tarasoff case. Most people don't have no idea what the Tarasoff case is, but it's a California case that we kind of learn about in our ethics class that is about the duty to warn or the duty to protect. Basically, this is a general summation. Please do not go back and say that I am giving you this gospel. I'm not an attorney. So basically with the cases, there was a gentleman who went on a couple dates with a young lady. She decided she didn't want to talk to him anymore. She didn't want to date him anymore. He became a little bit aggressive or suicidal or whatever it is. He ends up going to a psychologist or psychiatrist, a counselor on campus, and tells them this, right? And the counselor's just like, I'm going to commit them, do the 72-hour hold. But they didn't tell the lady that this person is thinking about hurting you, right? So that's kind of what happened there. Then fast forward, he gets out. He is acting, for lack of a better term, that he's fine and everything's normal. He befriends this woman's brother, moves in, becomes a roommate, and then turns around and kills her, right? And so the big case that came out after her murder was that they were blaming the therapist for not warning her. Now, at the time, there was no law for it because the therapist was like, I couldn't tell her because, you know, that's a violation of the confidentiality, right?
And super important in the therapist world, too.
Exactly. I mean, that's a really big thing. You don't want to tell people things like that. So that case came about. And so the law changed in California that said, you know what, if there's a situation like this and you do believe that there is reasonable and plausible, you know, belief that this person could kill this other person or truly harm this person, you do have a duty to warn this individual, right? To mm-hmm. let them know, like, hey, there's a potential for this happening, right? Because mm-hmm. if you don't and something does happen, then you can get in trouble. But this is in California.
Mm-hmm.
after years later, it kind of came out, you know, a lot of other states, they didn't have a law for it. And a lot of states just kind of de facto kind of took it until somebody got in trouble in Georgia for it. Because they warned, I can't remember the case in Georgia, but it was a kind of a police situation. So a police officer got fired or got in trouble, and he went or he was on probation where he had to see a therapist. Went to the therapist, made threats about killing people on the force and all those different things. Because there's no duty to warn in the state of Georgia, the therapist was just like, I don't really know what to do. But because it's a de facto thing, it's like, well, I'm going to take this Tarasoff off case and I'm going to warn them. Warns them, cop gets fired, sues the therapist, and wins for violation of confidentiality. There's currently no law for therapists in the state of Georgia.
That's interesting.
To protect us in this situation. Are you familiar with that?
You know, it's funny because I knew it wasn't codified. I deal with it a lot in the criminal defense realm, especially if you're trying to get records on an alleged victim who might have said something that is exculpatory to your client. Is obviously important information. And so there's a weighing balance that the court has to look at.
Yeah.
And it looks at, you know, the value of the client patient or patient doctor confidentiality versus the need of the criminal defendant and due process there. So, you know, I'm always looking at it in that lens. I knew it wasn't necessarily codified, but that it was an ethical rule that the courts respected.
Mm-hmm.
So applying it to, you know, that kind of practical sense that you're talking about, I guess I just assumed that it was translated into that and didn't realize that there was really no avenue for y'all.
Yeah. So how would you, since do you primarily deal with defense? Is that correct? More so than?
Primarily criminal defense, but also more and more the commitment side of things, danger to self and others.
Do you do guardianship type stuff?
Some.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm often, probably 99% of the time, I'm turning people away on guardianship. In other words, it's telling them that it's not the route that they want to go.
Okay.
Reason being.
What is guardianship, by the way, so that the listeners can.
adult guardianship, to put it very simply, it is basically putting you in the spot that you would be in if you were responsible for caring for a child.
Mm-hmm.
So you are, the court has discretion to give you different powers as a guardian over what they call the ward, which is, you know, the equivalent to the child. So, you know, saying where they can live, access to their health information, consenting to certain medical procedures. There's a debate one side or the other whether psychiatric procedures are included in that. I would say that they are not, that it's expressly excluded. But that's generally what guardianship gives you, is just kind of the control that you would otherwise have as a parent.
Yeah.
And I think that I get, like I said, the vast majority is parents with children who are just starting to manifest these symptoms in that 18 to 25 range, but they no longer have that parental control.
Yeah.
And they want it back,
mm-hmm.
Especially since they see their child slipping away. And so, you know, the difficult conversation that I have to have with them is, you know, for one, what I've learned over the years, I grew up, my mama is schizophrenic, so I've been around it since I was a little kid. I'm a mama's boy through and through. She is an incredibly intelligent woman, a grant editor for Duke University, you know, not somebody who just sits on the couch all day. But I've learned from her and 1,200 clients over the years that, you know, one of the biggest obstacles is building rapport with somebody who is symptomatic, who doesn't want treatment.
Absolutely.
Or has been experienced, you know, had bad experiences in treatment before and doesn't want to go back. You know, how do you speak their language? How do you connect with them in a way where, they trust you and, you know, you can slowly encourage them. And I emphasize the word slowly. It requires a ton of patience, but getting them to the point where they start to, follow your lead a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, getting back to the guardianship issue, what I always tell parents is if you can't find patience from the beginning and you're essentially wanting to clamp down and take away their liberties or a lot of their liberties,
mm-hmm.
then you are destroying a lot of that rapport that you might otherwise be able to build. And so I think that's a tough message for parents because, it's the anxiety of knowing that, your kid, might do something that puts them back in the hospital or puts them in jail or whatever. But if you try to work the path of building rapport and relationship and respect with them where they don't look at you as threatening, and it's really what matters in their mind,
yes.
not yours,
yes.
then you're going to get a lot faster to a point where it's sustained management of their challenges rather than, if you destroy that rapport, you're just putting yourself back, probably a few years because you're their support system. They're not going to trust you if they feel like you're trying to take away their liberty. So that is a tough dichotomy. And I get it. And I hate having to tell parents that because nobody wants to have patience when their kid is in that position.
Yeah.
But I've learned over time, if you don't have patience, I think that's why the average time from first break to management is a decade.
Yes.
Because, they are looking for that support system that they can trust. And, when we aren't that for them,
mm-hmm.
Then they're just going to keep spinning their wheels. And that's tough. Now, on the other hand, somebody with early onset dementia or late stages of dementia, things that cannot be cured, guardianship serves its purpose there. But I think that in most cases, you don't want to pull that trigger early on.
Yeah.
If it can be avoided.
Okay. I do want to, with relates to guardianship, because we used to, I've heard people talk about it and they don't understand the difference between a power of attorney and guardianship.
Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of explain the difference? Because a lot of times people think that those terms are interchangeable and they're not.
No, no, not at all. and power of attorney, as it applies to this conversation, is probably Georgia calls it advanced healthcare directive.
Mm-hmm.
Many other states would call it a medical power of attorney. The difference really is who has control. So in a healthcare directive or a medical power of attorney, the person granting the power to an agent has full control to revoke that at any time.
Exactly.
So if they're sitting in Ridgeview and mom is trying to access information or make decisions or whatever else, and that person says, I don't want you doing that, then they're in a position where they can revoke it and there's nothing the agent, the designated agent, can do about it. On the other hand, guardianship is a court-ordered position. So in other words, the court has listened to the evidence and said there's an overarching need for somebody to take care of this person's health and safety, that whoever's given guardianship is that person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not overturned unless the court reviews the decision again, either by petition from the ward or from somebody else saying that they don't need a guardian or that guardian's not a person who should be serving them. So it's really about control. The guardian has control in the end after mm-hmm. a court order has been issued. For the most part, with power of attorney, the power belongs to the person who's granted that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you mm-hmm. so much for that clarification. Yep. So we're going to circle back a little bit to the duty to warn, duty to protect. How would you go about, say you had to defend, not the therapist, but you had to defend a client whose confidentiality was violated because the therapist believed that they were going to harm someone, right? Mm-hmm. So in the situation that I explained, the police officer, say you had to defend this police officer. He ended up winning, but would you have even taken on a case like that?
You're talking from the civil side, like the lawsuit side?
Yeah, the lawsuit side. So
a little bit out of my wheelhouse only because, I wouldn't be certain what the potential claims would be. And I think it's harder to establish things, especially when you're talking about, psychiatric malpractice,
mm-hmm.
which I think is why it's more of a niche field, is that you know, standards of care are a lot different in psychiatry and counseling than they are in issues of where you're really focused on physiological issues.
Very
you know,
true.
Somebody cuts the cord to a kidney, they're clearly violating standard care because the kidney can't work at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I think it gets much more nuanced when you're talking about issues of psychiatry and counseling and, you know, what is that standard of care? It's much more nebulous and where is that line? You know, the way that I always compared it was, you know, the same duty to warn that we might have. And I wouldn't even call it a duty for attorneys. It's more kind of an out in cases of the attorney-client privilege. So,
okay.
You know, the example that I always give is if I have a client that says, you know, sometimes I just think about slashing my mother's throat.
Okay.
That is not something that I could go to the police and say, hey, look, this guy's talking about slashing his mother's throat. If I have a client who says, I got this knife, when I get home, she's done. You know, that is the type of immediate concern that I would have the bar would probably say the duty to reach out at that point to somebody to say, this person's about to commit a very serious offense. You know, somebody's going to get hurt if, you know, y'all don't do something about it.
Okay.
So that's how I've always kind of maybe moved that framework into your field and that may be, you know, not how y'all look at it at all, but I think it's that immediacy.
Yeah.
You know, y'all know, and this is what I say to clients for how much more important the attorney-client privilege is in cases of mental health because of what I said before. I'm trying to build rapport with them.
Yeah.
So families want to know everything. What did you talk about? What did he say? You know, what did he do all this? And, you know, I got to say, look, he's trusting me that I'm not going to go spilling everything he's saying to me to somebody else. And I need that trust besides the fact that I have this ethical obligation. And so I think it's the same for y'all too. And,
yeah.
And where is that line of he's saying some of the disturbing things that I would like to work through with him, or this is a person who's about to go out and do something that might get someone else hurt and then get him in trouble as well. So that's kind of the line that I always look at.
That's kind of the line that most therapists have to work under. We have to work under the premise of immediacy, like you said. So someone saying that, so we always assess for suicidal ideations. So there's suicidal ideations, there's plans, and there's intents. And they're just like, well, what's the difference? And I'm like, well, if you say that, you know, if I wake up tomorrow, if I didn't wake up tomorrow and I'd be fine with that, that's a little bit different than I'm going to kill myself. Okay. And that's also a little bit different than I'm going to shoot myself. And that's a little bit different than I actually collect guns and I'm going to shoot myself. So as you can see, very different,
shades
exactly of what's going on. You're just like, all right. So we always ask, you know, if I'm assessing for, suicidal or homicidal intent, for something, you know, we have to ask certain questions of, okay, so what exactly is your plan? Right? I'm like, why would you ask them that? I'm like, because I need to know what the plan is.
I need to know a little more detail. Like
I need to know how serious this plan is. If you tell me, like, you know, I'm going to jump off the Grand Canyon, but you're afraid of flying and you live in Georgia, well, that might not be a situation that I'm going to put you in a facility for. Why? You're afraid of flying. So you would have to drive there. And by the time it takes days to get there, you might change your mind. Right. And so that's not an immediate situation versus I'm a gun collector and I'm going to go home and shoot myself. Very, very different.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point when it comes to the commitment side of things. That's one of the things that I get from families all the time is, you know, why will they not 10-13 him? Why will they not take him into the hospital? And, you know, that's another tough conversation. It's the law is you have to be a substantial threat.
Yes.
Or an immediate threat, rather, of substantial harm to yourself or other people as demonstrated by recent overt acts. And that is a very specific and high bar.
Thank you. I'm so
it's frustrating to death for families. I get it. But
it's frustrating to us as therapists sometimes because you're like, I believe, and the thing is, here's the thing to the families out there who think that as therapists, we're not doing our jobs. One of the things is there's a reason why the law is so specific, because back in the 1920s, you know, in 30s, they were literally just locking people up, locking, we'll just say women, for example, they were locking women up for months for being hysterical, right? husband's just like, she's just being too much. We're going to lock her up. And they would just lock, the women would just disappear into these institutions for months. And then they would come out and they would actually have a problem, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're locked up in those situations, it's different. So to prevent that from happening and just completely violating people, you can't just put a person in an institution for forever because they're frustrating or because you're afraid. Because that's a really big thing, like you've mentioned. Like parents are seeing their children or even children seeing their parents or whatever the situation is. They see the spiral. Mm-hmm. So they get afraid and they're trying to protect them. You can't protect somebody just by locking them away somewhere.
Right. And again, what happens to the rapport at that yeah. point? You know, the rubber really, as I'm sure you would agree, Naomi, the rubber really hits the road on groundbreaking treatment in an outpatient environment.
Yes.
You know, the CSUs, the crisis stabilization units, as I see it, are a breath. You know, it is something to keep something worse from happening.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't necessarily put Ridgeview in this category, but there are other private hospitals out there that put profits above the treatment of the patients who come into their hospital. And, you know, that, you know, psychiatric appointments or meetings with somebody for 90 seconds in a hallway is not treatment. And, you know, that is a traumatic experience mm-hmm. for someone, especially if that's their first experience with mental health, that kind of environment where, you know, it's an overcrowded unit. You've just got a bunch of people milling around.
Yeah.
And the only people that are really having in-depth conversations with them are the social workers.
True.
So, you know, it is a traumatic environment and not one that really lends itself to wanting to engage on an outpatient basis later. So I think you kind of want to be careful what you wish for
mm-hmm.
in just putting somebody in any old hospital for one, but you know, just the crisis stabilization units serve one major purpose.
Yeah.
And then it's that outpatient
exactly.
situation where you really make the strides.
That is, so I currently work in a private practice. And so outpatient therapy, I cannot stress that enough. Two things about that. And I'm sure and hopefully you can back me up on this. You can't force people to go to therapy, right? So you go to a stabilization unit. Stabilization units, you're only there, a crisis stabilization unit like Ridgeview or even a Grady or, you know, the list, a Peachford, and there's so many of them in Atlanta.
Yes, there are.
So many of them. So these stabilization units, you're actually only in there for about 3 to 5 days. That's usually what it is. And, you know, the thing about that is it is for stabilization.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the key thing that a lot of people are not realizing. Like, why aren't you keeping them longer? This is for stabilization. As you mentioned earlier, it is not to treat you beyond your state. Like once you're like, okay, they're no longer suicidal. All right. Like we need somebody else who may need this, mm-hmm. you know, who is suicidal. When we discharge people from, at least I can only speak for Ridgeview. When you discharge someone, we had a discharge plan. The discharge plan usually included a therapist and a psychiatrist once they left. But here's the thing. We cannot force people to go. If they choose not to go, there is nothing.
Right.
That unfortunately we can do at that point in time. And I've literally had situations where they're like, I'm not doing this.
I get it. And, you know, look to me, this is what I've learned over time. You know, when I first got into this work and, you know, I don't doubt that this position is probably controversial, but when I first got into this work, you know, my approach was very much, you are sick, take your medicine and you'll be better.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't you taking your medicine? Just take your medicine mm-hmm. and everything's going to be better and you'll be up here with us and you'll,
yeah.
you'll be happy and everything else. And, you know, what I learned over time and then going through my own issues with major depressive disorder, when I was sitting there preaching to my clients and I wanted nothing to do with medications
yeah.
or therapy or anything else,
yeah.
you know, you start to realize that if it is a medication-centered approach.
Yes.
Then it is what I call kind of like a fingernails approach. You're not educating yourself about your challenges. You're not doing your own research about your challenges. You're not engaging with somebody who actually wants to talk, because psychiatry so much has devolved into this medication management type of situation. And, you know, you're not building the foundation underneath the medications that, if you get to the point where you don't like how medication feels, and let's be real, a lot of these psychotropics, especially the mood stabilizers, do not feel good. You want to change dosages, you want to change medications. If you don't have that structure, that relationship with a therapist, with a psychiatrist, where you can talk it out, then you got nothing underneath. You lose the medicines and you're right back to where you started. And I think that is the approach coming out of the crisis stabilization units that is unfortunate to me. The approach should really focus on the talking side.
Yes. You know,
the therapy over all else.
Yeah.
I often don't even bring up medications in my first conversations with clients because they're going to throw up a wall. And it's the talking, it's the education to me that kind of eases them into the idea of, you know, this combination of the crude tools of psychotropics along with educating yourself about your challenges. And that education part, the talking side, seems to be so pushed aside as somebody is coming out of a Peachford Ridgeview, Summit Ridge, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a, there's a difference between psychiatric treatment and counseling. It's people, psychiatric treatment tends to revolve around meds, as you said, as a, as
anymore,
right? It has a lot to do with that. Counseling is definitely centered around talk therapy, right? And so you do want to have both, but it's not a requirement. You definitely want the counseling part, right? Where you can build that rapport, as you've said. As it relates to some of your clients and the legal aspect of it, you've mentioned, you know, in the environment that we're in, we're going to run over a little bit and I'm fine with that.
No problem.
In the environment that we're in with so many, we've had a lot of mass shootings recently, right? And we've had a lot of, unfortunate situations where, there was some had a history of mental health issues. Other people didn't necessarily have a history of it, but when you look at some of the things that were going on, that not, like, I guess people missed the signs, you're like, okay, this is what's going on. How would an insanity plea work? How do it? Because people think they're just like, oh, I'm just, if I commit a crime, I can just plead insanity. And I'm like, no, it's pretty, I'm sure there's more stuff to it than that, or I'm assuming.
Right. And not only can't you, in a lot of circumstances, in most cases where you could, you probably don't want to, because I think there is a misconception that, you know, a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity means you walk out of the courtroom like you would if you were found not guilty. And that's not the case, at least here in Georgia. And I'm sure it's a lot the same in other states, especially after the Ronald Reagan Hinckley. Hinckley really changed the trajectory on a lot of that stuff, and states started to clamp down because they did not want a person in a position where they tried to kill the president of the United States and they're walking out, you know, a matter of, you know, a decade, 15, 20 years after it happened. So here in Georgia, the consequence of an NGRI finding is that you go to the hospital.
What is NGRI?
Not guilty by reason of insanity. And the consequence of that is that you go to the hospital and you are essentially assessed for 90 days. It doesn't have to be 90 days, but that's typically what they will assess for. And their determination, or what they're trying to figure out, is whether you meet those criteria we talked about before for hospitalization. It's the same language. Are you an immediate threat of substantial harm to yourself or others? But in the criminal sphere, it is treated much more strict than you would see in a 1013 type basis. And so where I called that bar so high in the 1013 realm, in the criminal realm, it is much lower, because the person making the decision ultimately as to whether the person gets in or out of the hospital is the criminal judge.
Okay.
And the judge is looking back. He's not supposed to, or she's not supposed to, but they're looking back at the offense. And the nature of the alleged offense, because you've essentially stipulated to the acts by employing
that defense. You pled guilty by saying, oh, okay, okay.
And so they're not supposed to look at that, but they are. And so certainly in less serious cases, I never go down that road. You know, the idea is approach your challenges differently. Stop looking at it as, you know, you just being sick. Realize that your mind is a lot more complicated and interesting and probably operating on a level higher than most of us sitting here, you know, start looking at it that way and understanding how it works and understanding how to approach it with education and medication. And then we can go to them and talk about either dropping the case or, you know, mitigating it to the extent that, you know, you're really not going to be affected. On the other side, you plead NGRI on a, you know, obstruction case, then you're going to the hospital for 3 months, if not more, for something that you might otherwise just walk away from if you just worked on your situation before. And, you know, things like murder cases. I don't get a lot of sex offense cases in my line of work.
Okay.
But aggravated assault murder cases, those types of cases, NGRI is a more viable defense. But again, the rung you have to reach in most states, and here in Georgia, it's essentially that either your symptoms were so acute that you could not tell the difference between right or wrong at the time that you were doing it.
Okay.
Or you were under the influence of a delusional compulsion that you could not resist. Okay. And that compulsion or that delusion that you were under, if it were real, would otherwise be justified. And so the example I give is if I'm walking down the street and, you know, I see a blonde person and my delusion is I need to stab every blonde person walking down the sidewalk, that would not be a legitimate defense unless the right or wrong prong applied.
Okay.
With delusional compulsion, that's not a justification that, you know, you go after any blonde person. On the other hand, if a blonde person walking down the sidewalk and my compulsion says that person's going to stab you if you don't stab them first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is the type of delusional compulsion that would be justified under other circumstances if it were real. So it's a very high standard to reach to begin with. And you really, in those serious cases, have to start mapping it out from the very beginning, because you're looking back in time when you're trying to show that person was acutely symptomatic.
Okay.
So you got to get data as close to that period of time as possible. So I will oftentimes get orders from judges to bring video cameras into the jail just so I can record my client.
Okay.
And then, you know, at whatever point we have to talk about that defense down the road when they're competent to stand trial, then, you know, we can talk about whether we want to use that videotape or not. But it allows somebody like a forensic psychiatrist to get in there and see data as close to that period of time as possible and say, yeah, clearly they were operating under some sort of psychosis at that time. And, you know, they can establish it a lot easier than 18 months down the road. They're just trying to guess based on what they see in a police report or witness reports or whatever else. Difficult strategy. And then, you know, the other side of the consequence is that for a case like that, you're looking at years in a hospital. In almost every case, it's very difficult to get a judge to agree to let you out of the hospital, even if the evidence, the forensic evidence, falls in your favor.
So if a person, so you say they have to be monitored for 90 days, which is, this is all new to me. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
So, if they're evaluated, I don't want to say got off, but that's what's coming to mind, but they got off because of a plea of insanity, mm-hmm. right? So they have to be assessed, as you said, for 90 days at a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
If they're assessed and, I guess, found to have an issue,
mm-hmm.
do they have to stay?
So if the doctors who are doing the assessment find that they are that immediate threat of substantial harm to themselves or other people,
mm-hmm.
As demonstrated by recent overt acts, and they're kind of looking at the criminal case again, they shouldn't be, but they are in those circumstances. What the doctors are looking for is, do they meet the criteria that they would for a 1013? And if they feel they do, then the judge can either just issue an order saying, keep that person, keep working on them. Or if the person wants, they can have a hearing to try to challenge whatever evidence the doctors are putting up. You are going to lose every time. I promise you, I have tried. It doesn't work. You're going to lose if you try to challenge the state doctors, because The judges don't want the proverbial blood on their hands. They're elected officials. They don't want to be in a position where they are...
They release someone.
Releasing somebody who might go back out and do something that...
Who's already
that
admitted
they just
to
did,
it. To, oh,
right, that they
wow.
just stipulated doing. So you're going to lose every time, especially on the more serious ones. The less serious ones, if you ever have them, and again, I don't pursue NGRIs on really any of those.
Yeah.
You're more likely to see a doctor come back and say, this person's been stabilized for months now. They're good to go.
Okay.
But then after that, it is you can
it's
go
on your
year
record.
By year.
Is it on your record since you have an acquittal?
The disposition would say NGRI not guilty by reason of insanity.
Okay, so if they pull up your record, so that is on your record.
That's what it would say.
Ooh.
Yep.
Ooh.
And then you know you're in a hospital really for as long as you continue to meet those criteria. There are procedures by which you come back into the court annually or by petition or whatever else. But, you know, it's really up to the committing court, which is the criminal court, to make that decision. And
really?
You're relying very heavily on the state doctors. So in the cases that I get, you know, I don't get a ton of these, but in a lot of them where, you know, it's a person been in for several years, and their family wants them to start moving. They've felt like they've been kind of stalled out for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my approach is very organic again. It's trying to get in there and do what I do with any client, trying to speak their language and talk to them about, you know, if you're going to move forward, you need to start looking at this differently. And you need to work with your team in a different way and, you know, talk with them about medications and dosages and all that kind of stuff. Because I know if I don't get the state doctors on my side, I'm not going to win.
Yeah.
Even if I have an independent person coming in, it's just not going to happen.
Oh,
not on
wow.
a serious case like that.
Mm-mm. Wow, wow, wow. So I know that we are definitely over time.
No problem. This
is there
fun.
Anything that you want to say? I'm definitely going to have you back because I'm sure I'm going to have lots of comments and questions
anytime.
On this. Hopefully you will come back.
Of course.
So is there anything that you kind of want to wrap the recording up with that you want people to kind of know as it relates to this? I know we couldn't dig into everything as much as, you know, time's limited, but is there anything that you can say, all right, I want you guys to kind of know this or think about this as it comes to the legal aspect of dealing with the, you know, the mental health arena?
I think more than anything, what I like to get across is to almost focus less on the legal part.
Okay.
You know, I, a lot of times will tell families, let me drive that boat in the courtroom. You know, I know how to handle those things. What I need you to do is start approaching your situation differently. So you'll notice I don't use the words illness or sickness a lot because I know, for one, it's not going to get me anywhere with clients. And
mm-hmm.
secondly, you know, as I'm sure you see, Naomi, so many of these people are so highly intelligent, maybe not in
extremely,
the conventional
yes.
IQ type of way.
And even then, sometimes they are. They just have a block.
Yeah. And then sometimes just mostly super creative in
extremely.
One realm or another.
Extremely.
Painting, writing, music, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so the message that I always want to get across to parents is, one, you have got to have patience in this or you're going to lose.
Yes.
And secondly, you know, start looking at it less about how do I get my kid to take medications? Because that's always the first question. And start
yeah.
looking at it more of, you know, how do I establish communication with my kid? Because that's what I'm trying to do to start. You know, I'm not trying to treat them. I'm not trying to be their therapist. I'm not trying to be their psychiatrist. I'm trying to be the person beforehand that gets them to want
mm-hmm.
to go do those things. And so it's making them look at their situation differently, something to be proud of in understanding how their mind works, not something where, you know, they're less than and they
yeah.
need to be up here with the rest of us. You
mm-hmm.
know, it is, you know, you're probably dealing with a mind that's better than mine.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to learn how to rein that in, you know, the combination of medications and education. And I think you start talking to your kid that way or your loved one that way, then you are going to get a lot farther, a lot quicker.
Okay.
As long as you understand quicker is not fast. It's quicker.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's the overarching theme, I think.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being the amazing guest that you are.
Well, thank you. I had fun.
Definitely we'll have you back so we can talk, probably dig deeper into the statistics maybe of, you know, what's going on out there. How does treatment look like for some of the clients that you deal with? But I want to thank you. Thank you very much. Do you
thank
have
you.
Any social media handles that you want to shout out, spit out there?
Oh, I'm not much of a plugger, but
okay.
You can There is, I will say, the blog at thegagefirm.com. If you go to the blog, most of the stuff that I post is just fascinating research articles that I find, because I love to research. I encourage my clients to research. So, you know, go out there, look what's on the horizon, look at the new studies. We know nothing about the mind, you know, compared to other things. It is a wide open world, and I like to throw those out. So if that interests people, then that's usually what I'm posting on the blog, is just neat new studies.
What's your website?
TheGageFirm.com.
All right. So go and follow him, or go to his website at TheGageFirm.com. And if you have any issues as it relates to legal issues, so I always tell my clients, which is like, look, if I'm ever ordered to hand over your stuff, I will violate confidentiality because I am not going to jail. But now I have someone that I can send you to. So I'm not going to jail, but I will send you to Attorney Gage. Like, here's someone that you can go to. I'm going to hand over these records, okay? And I hope that you all join us for our next episode. Can't wait to see you then. Thank you for being with us today. Y'all have a wonderful day. And of course, always try to be the best version of you. All opinions shared on this podcast are solely that of the participants and do not reflect the views of any governing mental health professional board. The host of this podcast has received written consent to share any and all stories that have been presented.